Solitary Man might be at least among Neil Diamond's best songs. That tune turns 50 years old this year. 50 years ago, Solitary Man came out. I think we need to come up with a new level of recognition or some sort of a coast to coast award for our next guest tonight. Writer, producer, filmmaker Paul Davids not only watched the Oscars this evening, he attended, but instead of going to some post-Oscar bevy of Hollywood bashes, he's joining us on Coast to talk about his next project, exploring life after death. In particular, the life after death of a good friend of his, Forrest J. Ackerman, who was a legend in the sci-fi horror monster genre, who seems to be reaching out from beyond the grave to his friends in a series of very strange events. We'll explore the story and the evidence right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Paul Davids is a graduate of Princeton University and the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies. He's been very active through the years in trying to end the official UFO truth embargo. I think listeners to this program might know him best for the film Roswell. He executive produced a couple of years ago the story of Jesse Marcel and what happened in 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico. And he has, Paul, on the over the years, has taken his case to regarding disclosure directly to former President Clinton on several occasions. We are glad to welcome him back to the program. Paul, good to have you here.
George, thank you for having me tonight. And it's always a great pleasure to talk to you.
I think we should thank you. I mean, there's got to be some parties you could have been going to tonight, right?
Well, the governor's ball that has a very hefty price to it. It's around, I think, $1,500 now. So we passed on that this year. But my wife and I did go to the Oscars, and it was a great show.
We're not going to dwell on the Oscars, but we got to talk to a little bit. I don't know anybody who goes to the Oscars, so share with us something. Any surprises? Anything that jumped out at you?
Well, I've been going to the Oscars for about 10 years in a row, by the way. And as far as the surprises in the special effects category, big surprise, because Ex Machina was given the best special effects, and it was up against Star Wars. It was up against Revenant, which had extraordinary special effects, Mad Max. So, I mean, we wondered, was this a case of sort of the vote getting split? But Ex Machina was a very provocative film. Special effects were great. Just, I thought, not quite on the scale of those other pictures. So that was one, I think that was one of the main surprises. Also, the fact that Sylvester Stallone did not win for supporting actor, but instead, the actor who was in Bridge of Spies, who played the Russian spy, he was the winner.
Well, it was a great role, but I think everyone pretty much figured Stallone had it in the bag, huh?
I think he felt that he was owed it, but that didn't happen. But I loved Bridge of Spies, and
Are you a
so
member of the Academy?
my wife is a member of the Academy. My wife is Hollis Davids, and she's a senior VP of special projects at Universal Pictures, where she's been for almost 20 years. And
She needs to green light one of your movies, doesn't she?
she has a producer credit on almost all of my movies. We kept her name off of Jesus in India because we thought maybe that one was too controversial for somebody working for a Fortune 500 company. But she has credit on most of them. Though not Roswell, because that was produced by Showtime and was developed under separate circumstances. But when I began doing the independent films, starting with Timothy Leary's Dead and Starry Night and then the Sci-Fi Boys and on and on and on, because I've done about 10. Hollis has a producer credit on all of them.
Let's talk about Forrest J. Ackerman, J without a period, by the way.
Yes.
Tell us who he was. Rattle our cages a little bit and our memories, and remind us who he was and what a giant figure he was in this field.
Forrie had his house was an 18-room mansion. They called it the Acker Mansion in the Los Feliz area of Los Angeles, kind of near Griffith Park. And writer Ray Bradbury called it the Fort Knox of science fiction. And the reason he said that was that Forrie, going back to the days of silent movies, collected everything he could get his hands on that would be a prop or some kind of memorabilia or lobby cards or posters from all of the science fiction movies, and he didn't care whether they were good or bad. He collected, you know, from the grade Z movies up to the best. His one of his favorites was King Kong, the original. And, you know, he was a young man when that came out in 1933. I'm sure he was there. He was there opening night at the Grauman's Chinese. Metropolis by Fritz Lang, silent movie, one of his other favorites. Afari distinguished himself by being the first person who internationally promoted science fiction into the mainstream, because it was always way off on the fringes. It was never considered real literature. And academics looked down their noses at it, and colleges didn't teach it. But Fari, through becoming the editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, about 200 issues, brought to, first of all, to my generation, the baby boomer generation, and then to two subsequent generations, including Peter Jackson, brought a knowledge of all of these films, what went on behind the scenes, how special effects were done, the craftspeople. He brought this at a time that this information really was not available. And we feasted on it, we grew up with it, and many of us went into the business as a result of this man. So he's like the godfather and the forefather of movie science fiction.
And you crossed paths with him at a young age.
Yes, I was really lucky to meet Fari when I was 13 years old. And I had been a fan of his magazine, you know, from the very beginning. I mean, it started in 1958, and then it cost 50 cents. That issue number one that was 50 cents, now, you know, you're lucky if you can get it for $1,000. So as a kid, I read the magazine, every issue, and then was really fortunate to meet him at a World Science Fiction Convention in Washington, D.C. in the early 1960s. I think it was the Statler Hilton Hotel down in Washington, D.C., and I had been a kid who made 8mm silent films, trying to emulate the films I loved. So I had mummies and monsters and dragons and creatures of all kinds and flying saucers. And I had a chance. I was invited by Fari, when I met him on a Saturday, to come back Sunday morning with my projector and show my little 8mm films to him, his publisher, and a whole group of around 20 kids who were science fiction fans. And from that moment on, I was hooked.
That's got to be huge.
I mean, he was my idol. And within a month of that, his publisher was writing to me, asking me for stills from my movies to publish in their magazine. In those days, before the internet, those of us who had these kind of specialized interests and tastes had no way to know who we, you know, contact each other to know who we were, except like in the pages of a magazine where they would have a reader's section at the bottom, at the end. He called his Graveyard Examiner, where kids could write letters and you'd find out who the fans were, who their addresses, what their addresses were. And that way we began to correspond. So at an early age, I'm corresponding with someone like Dennis Muren when he's a teenager. And as you know, Dennis Muren went on to be he's got like 10 Academy Awards, the biggest special effects guru at Industrial Light and Magic, you know, from Jurassic Park on. And Bill Malone, I knew from the time we were both children. He's directed a lot of horror films, television, remake of Masters of Horror on TV, remake of House on Haunted Hill, and others, Don Glut, who's made a lot of dinosaur films. We knew each other as kids, and the relationship stayed together, but it all revolved around this man, Fari, who we deeply loved. And he had a massive, massive influence on movies in our time because he encouraged Spielberg, Lucas, they all read his magazine, Peter Jackson from Fari's magazine. And Peter agreed to appear in a movie I made about all this called The Sci-Fi Boys in 2006.
Yeah, I've got it. I've got that.
Yeah. Yep. It won some Ebby Awards, by the way, at the UFO Congress.
Yeah, it's excellent.
So Fari was a big part of my life, and I've got to say that it was about a half a century, and he died at age 92, and he was an atheist. And he was. So when your listeners wonder why I call my new book, which they can just find at Amazon now, I mean, like, It's a pre-order, but we're going to be shipping books in just a couple of weeks. And it's called An Atheist in Heaven. And I want to say I'm not religious, and that word heaven, my co-author and I use it in the broadest, loosest sense of the term, meaning, you know, everybody's got their own view of it. But the idea is that something of us goes on after we die, you know, if there is a heaven. You know, we hope for that, but, you know, the feeling is always, you know, nobody knows, except for the really religious people who feel, well, they know, and their source is the Bible. But I'm not one of those. So Fari was an atheist and a card-carrying atheist. You know, he was a skeptic about everything, including UFOs. And he said before he passed away, because I said to him, you know, Fari, what if you're wrong? You know, and he said, well, I sincerely doubt that I'm wrong. But if I wake up to some big science fiction convention in the sky, he says, I'll be really busy with my old friends, Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre and George Pal, and of course, my wife, Wendane. He said, but sooner or later, when the party dies down, you know, maybe I'd get around to dropping you a line. And he said that sort of in jest with a, you know, wink. And my life absolutely changed, George, when he dropped me a line. It happened. There was physical evidence. It happened many, many times. I mean, it started in March of 2009. And in the new book, An Atheist in Heaven, I begin it with a sworn affidavit, because I have to let people know that I'm swearing that my account of all of these very unusual phenomena that happened to me really did happen. They're not made up, they're not exaggerated, none of it is fiction, but it's very, very, you know, hard to believe with our rational minds.
Your co-author, PhD, Gary Swartz, also has an intro that says, I'm telling you, this is true. And he says, and he wrote that it's the only time he's ever had to write that in any of his books or
he says he's warning you that it's true, that you're going to find it hard to believe. And he also says that when I first came to him with this information, he had to be suspicious. You know, he had to be a skeptic. He has a reputation to defend. He's a professor at University of Arizona, Tucson, who for, I would say, about 15 years has studied evidence for life after death. He's done comprehensive studies using mediums, but he's also gotten into technology. And we call that instrumental transcommunication. He's developed software to do it. He's developed sensors, graphs, ways to detect spirit. And these are bona fide scientific studies. So when I come to him with this story that I've heard from my mentor after he died repeatedly, he writes in the foreword, you know, I had to be suspicious and cautious about this guy and skeptical, because Paul David's, he's written fiction. Yes, I wrote a bunch of the Star Wars sequel books. So, yes, I'm into science fiction. I have been always. And what else did he, alarm bells? That I'm a member of the Magic Castle in Hollywood, and magicians deceive people. They perform magic. And yes, that's part of who I am too. But what I brought to him, I mean, it was like, you know, it's like a sinner going to a priest wanting to make a confession. But I took my confession, not only Gary Swartz, I took my physical evidence of this contact to top professors at two universities who got involved, who studied the physical evidence I presented. It became a 3-year study. It baffled them, tear their hair out over it.
We're going to go through it, Paul. We're going to go through it step by step. I just want to go back to Forrest Ackerman now. He's an atheist. He's a skeptic. Even though he deals in the realm, it's his business, it's his passion, dealing with monsters, aliens, sci-fi, horror, right? Even though that's his
he believes
his,
in none of it,
bailiwick.
His parents were spiritualists. They used a Ouija board. He confesses that there was a Ouija incident that was instrumental to his grandfather deciding to take the job of designing the famous Bradbury Building in Los Angeles. That's the, what's the famous film that they made there? It'll come back to me. But no, he rejected it all. You know, his parents took him to 12 different churches and even a synagogue when he was growing up. And his grandparents tried to, and then they gave up. It wasn't for him.
So he says, all right, look, I reject all that. I'm a skeptic. I'm an atheist. But if I die and then there's something going on there, I'll drop you. Maybe I'll drop you a line. And then literally,
he sort of drops you a line. He's an editor. He deals in lines of text.
So March of 2009, what happened? Let's start it off.
Okay, let me just precede it.
Okay.
One other addendum to what we were just saying. His specialty is puns and wordplay. He's very, very gifted at this. It's seeing how to twist words to make jokes, how to find names within words, words within words, how to twist the meaning of something through a little subtle change in a word. And he could always get people laughing through this. This punning was a very, very special gift he had. Like some people have, you know, photographic memory. He could do this. And he did it in the pages of his magazine, always with these jokes and puns and words within words. So that background of Fari was part of how I came to realize what was happening to me, because the first incident happened to me. There had already been an incident with two Canadians, but the first one that happened to me was in March of 2009, and a week before we had held this huge tribute for him at the Egyptian Theater in Los Angeles. I think we filled every seat. I think, you know, I don't know, 800, 1,000 people were there. I was one of the speakers there. There were about 10, including Ray Bradbury, by the way. And even Peter Jackson sent a tape to be played of him talking about Fari all the way from New Zealand. So what happened to me was, I realize that maybe I'm rambling, but here's what happened. I have a second home in Santa Fe. I was alone on a trip there. No one else was in my house. Was tax time. I printed out a document of my phone calls, business meetings of the previous year, 24 pages. While the printer was printing, I went out. I like to play blackjack. I went to an Indian casino for about an hour and a half, had dinner, and then I came back. And I picked up the document. Now it was printed. The ink was obviously dry. It'd been an hour and a half, and there was nothing strange or unusual about the document. I put it down on the bed. I went into the bathroom. I was there maybe 5 minutes, and when I came out of the bathroom, the document had been changed. I had been dropped a line, literally. There were four words very precisely, neatly, strategically targeted and blacked out on the document. That was number one. That's how it all began.
And what were the lines? What were the words?
The words, it made no sense.
Right.
Because the words were, spoke to Joe Amodi. And January 3rd, I think it was, there'd been a phone call, spoke to Joe Amodi. I don't know if it was the 3rd, maybe it was 4th or 5th, I can't remember exactly, but a day or two before, I had written down, left message for Joe Amodi. So whoever blocked out these words didn't choose to block out left message. It was spoke to this man. Now, this man is somebody I hardly even knew. I'd spoken to him once in my life, lived in New York. He was a film distributor. He hadn't been interested in the distribution of Jesus in India, which is why I had called him. And we hadn't talked again. So I was saying, why? Why does this, you know, I mean, I some intelligence, some independent agent that I couldn't see was somehow in my house at that time and blocked out those words. But why spoke to Joe Amodi?
And the ink was still wet.
Yes. As I stared at it, and then I held the piece of paper in my hand, but not touching the ink, because I regarded it as some kind of evidence right away, which I didn't want to spoil. But it was still wet. It was clear it had just happened. And the thing is, George, the blackout was so precise, but it was in two levels of blackout. So the first two words, spoke to, you could kind of read through and see that the words were spoke to. But the next two words, the man's name, completely blacked out.
And well, we'll explore what the man's name and the significance of it, because there are 140 other instances that follow this one, and it gets pretty strange. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Other Side, take us into the break. We're talking with Paul Davids. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ghosts prevail in this haunting song from Genesis, 1983, Home by the Sea. We're talking with Paul Davids about his new book, An Atheist in Heaven. And as you just heard, it starts off sort of innocuous. He prints out a document at home by himself. He goes away for an hour and a half, comes back, takes a look at it, throws it on the bed. And when he comes back in the room 5 minutes later, somebody has tampered with it. Somebody or something has drawn a line through a particular part of this document in ink, and the ink is still wet. Now, there's nobody else in the place. How did it happen? This starts a chain of events in Paul Davids' life, in which he explores a variety of different opinions, scientific and otherwise, to try to figure out what went on. And it all comes back to his dear departed friend. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Paul, you're home alone. You print out a document, several pages. You take a look at it. You throw it on the bed. You go out of the room. You're back in 5 minutes, and you look at it, and somebody has messed with it. They've drawn a line through one particular line in ink. Part of the line is opaque. You can still read the words that are blacked out. Part of it is completely obscured. Did you immediately make a connection somehow to your dear departed friend, or just thought, oh, that's odd?
You know, George, this really personal with me, having lived this. I was scared. I was really scared when this happened. I don't know how to explain it, you know, practically trembling. I mean, I was alone in the house, and this just couldn't have happened. You know, I'm a rational person. I went to Princeton. I studied science. I have not been a believer in ghosts. You know, yes, I'm into the whole UFO thing. You know, there's a lot of evidence on that, a lot of documents. There's a whole history with that. But this stuff, no, no. And I was afraid. And I felt, you know, I asked, a thousand things went through my mind. You know, was I in the presence of a demon? Was this ill intention toward me? And I called out to whatever spirit might be there that if it didn't have my best interests at heart in this, to just please get the hell out of there. I wanted nothing to do with it, unless this was for some high purpose. So I was just afraid, and I took a lot of pictures around that house that night. You know, sort of looking, are there any orbs in these pictures? And you know, being alone in the house was very unsettling, and it took days for me to get to the bottom of what the message meant. I did start to associate it with Fari for this reason. The weekend of the tribute, there were two Canadian filmmakers in town who'd made a biography of Fari. And they had gone to his crypt before the tribute, and they had, one of them had, Michael McDonald, rapped on his crypt playfully and said, hey, Fari, it's us, we're here, you remember Ian and Mike. And they said this wasn't intended disrespectfully. They never would have done this with anybody else, but they knew Fari's sense of humor, his sense of jest, and they felt, you know, it was in the spirit of who Fari was. And they had gotten back to the room in the hostel that they were staying at, and they heard from him, they explained to me. One of them was blogging something on his computer. He got a CAPTCHA code that he had to fill out, the letters, the squiggly letters, and the CAPTCHA code was Ackerman's name. I mean, it was Ackerman 000, and he was aghast at this. And his friend looked at it and said, oh, God, you know, is he really dead? And a voice from the second computer on the desk, which had been asleep, spoke out in a childlike voice and said, oh, my gosh, no way. And they were freaked. They found out that that voice, oh, my gosh, no way, is an animated emoticon that you can find on YouTube. But he wasn't logged on to YouTube. As he said, his computer had no business speaking to him. So I knew that had happened to them. Then this happens to me. Now, I began to wonder, could it be connected to Fari? And I I wanted to see examples of his editorial style. I wanted to see a manuscript with his lines blacked out, crossing out certain things. This was more than just a cross out through it. This was really opaque. It was so neatly done. So I wanted to know, did he do things like that? And I had a book that had some of his old manuscripts in it, and I looked through it, and I saw one. I thought, you know, but I wasn't sure whether it was by him or his publisher, the cross-outs in that manuscript. So I called a guy I know who was Fari's closest caretaker the last 10 years of his life. He lived with Fari, took care of his every need, as loyal as any human being could be, and this is the guy that arranged Fari's tribute. And he's a Hawaiian named Joe Moe. And before I could even ask Joe if he had any manuscripts, Joe said, "Paul, I got to tell you something incredible." He said, "You know, I'm a skeptic like Fari was. I don't believe in this stuff, but I had some kind of apparition of Fari coming to me after the tribute, and speaking to me, and in his own way thanking me for the tribute. He said it was the ninth wonder of the world." Joe said, "Couldn't have been the eighth wonder of the world, because that's King Kong, and Fari would never insult King Kong, you know. But the ninth wonder of the world." And then Fari vanished. And Joe was shaken. He said, "It's like Fari came and spoke to me." And at that moment, I freaked out. And Joe said, it sounded to him like I just put my hand on a stove. Because I realized that what was blacked out of my document was "spoke to Joe Amodi." A name within a name, Joe Moe, is in Joe Amodi. So it was a code. It's what Fari would do. He was always finding the name within the name. And Joe had been skeptical about this apparition, you know, didn't know if it was some kind of hallucination. But yet it's confirmed for me by Fari writing down for me, "I spoke to Joe Moe." He thanked him for the tribute. So this thing that had freaked me out and frightened me, and I wondered if it was a demon, I became convinced that this was probably from Fari directly. And by saying that he spoke to Joe Moe, you know, check with Joe Moe, he thanked Joe Moe, that it was almost like a way of thanking me for speaking at his tribute. You know, talk about a friendly ghost. Now, this was step number one. Fari has been visiting me now for 6 years. It has never stopped. And I've got to add in here, I know we're going to go on, you'll ask a lot of questions, but I want your viewers to know, as I began investigating this and taking the evidence to scientists and interviewing people, I made a documentary film about it. Many of your listeners may have seen that. It's called The Life After Death Project. It even has its own website, lifeafterdeathproject.com. And they showed that on the Sci-Fi Channel. And then I made a sequel to it, and then they both became DVDs and all that. But Gary Schwartz, who is in the film and did research with all of this stuff, said he talked to his colleagues who said, "Gary, you should get Paul to write a book about this, because a documentary is never going to satisfy the scientific community. We've got to see it in writing. It's got to have chapters we can study, and we want the scientific data." You know, he took this stuff to chemists. They studied it for 3 years. We want to see their scientific reports. We want to see all your data with your sensors, because you're saying now you're communicating with Fari through instrumental transcommunication. Had to be a book. It grew and grew and grew over 3 years. It became 500 pages with a glossary of all the incidents that have happened. And for me, it's my contribution, you know, to the paranormal field. It's, you know, I did it because I had to do it. It had to all be put down, and I stand by the fact that it's all true. And that's why we're having this conversation.
You have a juxtaposition of Houdini versus Arthur Conan Doyle in the film, the sci-fi film.
Yeah.
The position of Houdini, who was, you know, a debunker of psychics and flim-flam artists. And then Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, but a person with deep interests in these kinds of topics, seances, psychics, things of that sort. Why was that necessary as part of a vehicle for telling this story?
Well, now in the film, I don't think I got into Houdini so much. I certainly did get into Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. In the book,
right.
I get much more into Houdini, because these two historical figures were in a gentlemanly dispute, like we have our dispute with the skeptics today. But they were at each other's throats about spiritualism and life after death and can we hear from somebody who's departed. And I get into this in the book because Houdini was the main spokesman. I mean, he was like the Philip Klass or the Michael Shermer, you know, of his day, saying, he says, I don't believe it's so. It's full of flim-flam. He went to Washington, D.C. to try to get a law passed, sort of outlaw mediums, taking money from people, bilking money for something that he felt had absolutely no foundation. Whereas Sir Arthur Conan Doyle said, look, I don't think this stuff is true. He said, I know it's true. And knowing a thing is true is different than thinking it's true. Because through personal experience, he had come to the conclusion that he was hearing from departed people and that this was real. So I set up the book this way by saying, look, the way I was raised, the way my parents raised me, I was on Houdini's side of this argument. You know, I would have said flim flam, don't believe any of it. Mediums, I don't think so. But now I'm on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's side of the argument. Life experience that I never asked for, never expected, has changed me, has educated me, has opened my eyes. And I listen to some of the most virulent skeptics, close-mindedness, debunking, attacking. And I, you know, they attacked me after the movie. And one of those skeptics actually had an extraordinary experience. One of the best-known skeptics in America, Michael Shermer, after the movie came out, and he was in it, about a year or so ago, he had his own experience.
He just wrote about it, didn't he? He wrote about it in
Scientific American.
Right.
Yeah. But the point is, I was over 40, you know, before I had experiences that got me interested in UFOs as something real, and then this, of course, later. And I never asked for it. You know, the point is, Fari was a futurist. He was forward-thinking. He valued the works of Jules Verne, you know, whether it's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or H.G. Wells, you know, the first trip to the moon. He was always calling attention of society to the fact that science fiction is showing us a future that could come to pass. And in the 1930s, he and Ray Bradbury believed that mankind would set foot on the moon in their lifetime. And they were ridiculed for that. You know, they were laughed out of town. You know, he lived many years beyond that. So I think that if anybody was to alert us or tell us that there is something after and we go on and he retained his sense of humor, I think it would have been Fari.
Well, there is a playful quality to many of the incidents that we're going to talk about. There's a trickster element to it.
Yes.
Where he seems to be having fun, if it's a he, and messing with not only with you and with people he knew, but people he didn't know, the scientists involved in the investigation.
That has been really intense. What's happened to these scientists has they cannot understand it. They cannot conceive it, but their view on all of this has changed too. But Fari always did have that sense of fun, playing with all of his readers, and he's been playing with me. And I have to say, you know, in the whole, you know, I enjoy it. I value it. I wouldn't want it any other way now. And I think that one of the greatest gifts anybody can have in this life is to have been really close to someone, a dear friend or someone they loved, a relative, a parent, and to have something happen after they're gone that convinces them that their presence is still there, that they're being notified. And I think it happens to lots and lots and lots of people since doing this. I don't know whether it's 50% of the people, but so many people say, yes, I heard from my grandmother. I heard from my mother. I knew it was her. And here's why. And I'm just trying to alert people to that through really telling my own story in all of its dimensions. And it flourished once I got science involved.
Okay, you had this incident in your home where the line is crossed out. Then you talk to these Canadian filmmakers. They tell you about the what had happened to them, this weird thing with the computer and the sounds. And then you have the conversation with Joe Moe, who sort of had some kind of a lucid dream where Forrest Ackerman appears to him and speaks to him. Did you tell Joe Moe what was going on with you at that point? And if so, what was his reaction?
Yeah, I did. And Joe found it incredibly interesting, but he clings to his skepticism, you know.
That's all right. Yeah.
He won't relinquish it until he has to. But he found it extraordinary, and it seemed like Fari. But the ace I had up my sleeve was this. I have a cousin who is one of the greatest forensic chemists in the country. His name is Dr. Jay Siegel. And for many years, he was the chairman of the chemistry department at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And I called up Jay Siegel after this happened. And he's known me since childhood. And I said, Jay, well, I told him what happened. And I said, you know, there's chemistry involved here. I would really appreciate it if you would do a chemical analysis of this document and see if you can explain it. You know, if this can be explained away in some kind of conventional terms, I would love to know that, and then I'll rest my mind on the whole thing. Well, he agreed, and I flew to Indianapolis with the document. I kept chain of custody, it never left my hands, and he began experiments that continued soon thereafter in New Jersey with Dr. John Allison of the College of New Jersey. Who had special equipment that Dr. Siegel did not have.
Well, let's leave it with Dr. Siegel. What
Yeah,
were the
yeah.
tests that he conducted, and what did he find?
He did mass spectrometry. He is an expert in inks and paints and solvents and dyes, and had conducted a special programming, amassing lists and the properties of thousands of those inks and paints and dyes. And he was looking for a match with the ink that I had. Now, he was not able to find a match, which disturbed him. And it also disturbed him the fact that while he was studying it, when I had my cameras going on in the lab in Indianapolis, there was a sleeping computer in view of this mass spectrometer. When the computer woke up and turned itself on to a program that he had already deliberately shut down. And this bothered him, you know, because this shouldn't happen. It had not happened before. So,
Yeah, it's on video. You captured it on camera. Yeah.
I captured a number of the weird things that happened on camera, mainly with John Allison. But when he hit a dead end, he got in touch with John Allison, and John Allison agreed, you know, that would then fly the document to New Jersey. Now, a couple of months went by before I could go there, and weird things happened during those couple of months. But eventually, he began a 3-year study. And one of the things I think that's so important about my new book with Gary Schwartz, An Atheist in Heaven, is a chapter written by Dr. John Allison about the chemistry, because he really lays it out, his whole investigation. He regarded me suspiciously at first, too, of course. I mean, with Jay Siegel, I was his cousin. And I told him, Jay, I'm telling you the truth. He had no reason to believe I would ever lie or that I would fabricate something or play a trick or something. No. But John Allison had to regard me as a suspect. You know, the question is, who made this? I said I was alone in the house. Well, was I? Did I do it? Was I involved somehow? I mean, he asked me 100 questions. He heard that I was an artist, and you know, yes, I had paintbrushes in the house. And well, he wanted me to bring old paintbrushes to New Jersey. He wanted to subject them to analysis. He wanted to see if anything that was in my paintbrushes showed up in the ink. And it began such a convoluted investigation for him that hit a dead end over 3 years. He kept it going 3 years. He never quit. Every new school year, he would get his whole class involved in the project to work on it, to see if they could explain what he hadn't been able to explain. And while he pursued this, the paranormal things that had begun with him while I was there continued and continued and became more and more pronounced, so that he became a recipient of the same kind of unexpected, unexplained phenomena that I was.
Well, we're going to pick up that part of the story after the break and hear what some of those incidents were that happened to this scientist who was being skeptical. And I've seen him on the film, and he is, you know, he's bemused and skeptical, which is probably as it should be. We're going to go into the break with Paul Simon, Slip Sliding Away from 1977. Back with Paul Davids in a moment.